This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Ramika Bingham Risher is here with a stunning new book, Soul Culture. But Ramika, what is the whole title of this book?
The whole title is Soul Culture, Black Poets, Books, and Questions That Grew Me Up. I'm like,
we each have one.
Oh, Grace, look at it in your hands. It looks so good, ma'am.
And did you find the answers to the questions as you wrote the book, or did you know them before you started?
Oh, not a chance. No, I found the answers, and only some of them, because there's still plenty of questions that linger. I think that's what poets and poems do for me. They help me address and maybe refine the questions, but they don't give me all the answers.
But this book is more than a book, Ramika. I read this book and I could not believe what I was reading, because it has more than soul culture. It has your essence, it has your spirit, as has your being in the world, as you try to figure out the world. And it is miraculous. Elizabeth Alexander said it was miraculous. And you know, that was the best word I could think of for this book. I mean, what do you feel when people say that to you?
Well, in particular, you know, I know we're supposed to be zen and pretend that we're cool. But in particular, when Elizabeth Alexander said it, I mean, that was probably the most I cried during the entire process. Because if you read the book, you'll know how deep and abiding my love is for her. And the same thing with you, Grace. You know, there I'd be hard pressed. Maybe you and E. Ethelbert Miller are the only poets that I know that talk to poets about craft on a regular basis, constantly. So I know how much you read and see. So for you to say that to me, it's a real gift.
Well, you know that it's all selfishness, because it keeps us alive. Oh. So this is our life force. But some of the poets, tell us who you featured in the book, because these are your guides.
Yeah.
And these are the people who you look to and learn from. And who are some of them?
A few of them. Well, first and foremost, for me, a poet that I go back to probably the most in the world is Lucille Clifton, who I got to sit with before she passed. Sonia Sanchez. The ones that are coming back today, there are 10 poets in total, but Forrest Hamer, Erica Hunt, Tim Siebels has really been kind of like a father figure to me in poetry. And so that essay with him really talks about him guiding me, and then my own father, how we've moved through a revision process in our lives. So, I mean, it kind of goes on and on. Just poets that really changed the way I thought about the world.
But instead of straight reportage, there is your wonder beneath every line. We get your awe. We get your sense of what you feel that these poets are, and you take a lesson from that. There is such a sense of wonderment in this book. It's like an innocence that you can't come back to. I have never read anything like it. I really, really do hope it wins that Pulitzer. So let's hear a little piece of it.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, from your mouth to God's ears on that Pulitzer. I'm just going to read a little excerpt from the first chapter, which is called Imagining Home. So the book started out because I was interviewing Black poets that I really loved, one of whom was E. Ethelbert Miller, who was also a graduate student professor of mine. So he figures here, but this essay is also about not only the places we think of as home, but our place in the literary community. Home is what we most desire, not just a mark on a map, but the dream of the thing we hold on to. Place, on the other hand, is where we fit in, or is sometimes the cramped road that what you think of as home gives you. Now, after being in the South, on the East Coast for more than 20 years, home feels like the thicket of trees across from the ocean, less than a mile up the road from my little Virginia cottage, but nearly impossible to make a way into without much struggle, probably pain in those thickets, though it looks beautiful from afar. I've grown up here too, found and lost loves, graduated several times, buried my grandmother, bought my first house, worked under Confederate statues. I wrote books and taught students much like myself. My relationship with every space I call home is knotty, intricate. This complexity, the weight and wonder of it, is indivisible. All the time I've been imagining home, I've also been thinking of a place for myself, a home in Black poetry. During our interview, E. Ethelbert Miller asserted that a successful living as a poet is about the distance you've traveled inside yourself. How do we dream a larger, more expansive space for ourselves than has existed for those who came before us? How do we walk in the shadow of those who walk alongside us, who teach us, and set a table for those coming after? As a child, I believed questioning what was thrust upon us was a small act of resistance. But now I know it's a lifelong striving, revolutionary, finding beauty in what haunts me.
Rameika Bingham Risher. She was a native of Phoenix, Arizona, a Cave Canem Fellow, an Appalachian poet.
Yeah.
And her work has been published in the New York Times, The Writer's Chronicle, Kowaloo, Essence. She's the author of Conversion, What We Ask of Flesh, Starlight, and Error, all award-winning books, and was a finalist for the Library of Virginia Book Award. Rameika Bingham Risher. What was the hardest part about starting to write this book? I mean, breaking the ice. There you are with all these ideas and all your little index cards and stuff on the envelopes on your computer. And you say, how do I begin this book?
What a great question. The hardest, there are two very distinct paths to the book. The hardest part about starting the book before I knew it was a book, which was just starting the interviews, was just asking people that I admired and thought of as untouchable to sit down with me for a few hours to have these discussions. And that was something that E. Ethelbert Miller thrust me into. So that was the hard part. Once I knew I was compiling these interviews and wanted them in some way to make their way out into the world, the hardest part of writing the book was garnering a wonderful agent, Larissa Mello Pienkowski, who said, I love everything that's happening here. Interviews don't sell. We've got to rewrite the whole thing. And so, you know, this book was very different when it went out into the world on submission. It had all of the full interviews and kind of little craft essays about something that I was really impressed that the writer could do well. So if I had an interview with Patricia Smith, I would write a little craft essay about how well she did persona poems, right? So it was a very different, really academic text and an homage to those elders. That's all it was.
That is so interesting because I was just going to say, it's not a mere question and answer book, you know, but here it began as that. But
yes.
What it finally turned out to be.
Absolutely.
Was an inimitable picture of a life.
Oh.
It what you did, your editor was really smart.
Listen, Haley Lynch, Beacon Press, and really much of that credit goes to both of them. You know, your agent is your first editor because we wrote this whole thing once before it went to editors. And Haley Lynch at Beacon Press said to me, you know, the Black women's interior voice is a voice we never get to hear enough. Let's lean into that. And I thought, that's so strange. I'm a poet. I never imagined people were interested in my living and how the poetry informed my life. And that's what the book became.
That is the whole reason the book shines.
Oh.
Because it's the story of a life in search. And I want to know what emotions you had to overcome as you wrote this. What feelings were so big that it was hard to pen them? What were some of the things you felt as you went through this and found out who you were in relation to this?
Right. I mean, there was great fear because I just didn't think of myself as a prose writer and certainly not a memoirist. In fact, when they released the Publisher's Weekly little blurb of what the book was and it said memoir, I said, oh my gosh, now I have to do that. Why would you people write that? Right. But it was a real gift to me. Other than that, it was really combing through real joy, which is one thing I wanted to make sure was there as well, particularly Black joy. In the midst of all of the crises that we were seeing at the same time, I started rewriting this book in March of 2020, when, you know, the pandemic kind of set us all down and forced us to focus on different things. And so that's what was happening. One of the essays goes back to dear friend of mine, Romaine Brisbane, who was killed by police in 2014, kind of in the long line that starts the Black Lives Matter movement. It was very, very difficult going back to those days when I was just so anxious every moment. I couldn't sleep. I was scared for my son, who, you know, I'd just been married and became a stepmom. You know, I was fearful of everything in those moments. And to go back and rehash that and think about what I learned from that was a difficult time. You know, there are other moments writing about revision and my dad, the last essay. I'm really happy it happened. It came together. But he was fighting cancer while we were he's in remission now, thank goodness. But while we were writing and editing this book, and that was something I never expected to happen, it kind of bowled us over in the middle of COVID. So that was a very difficult thing. So really just encountering life as it was and trying to figure out what those things taught me in the midst of still living through many of them.
What a pure piece of writing, without complaint, without envy, and without self-pity.
Oh, no.
I'd like to switch gears because I know a new book is coming out and I'm so competitive. I want to be the first one to hear the poems. So you're going to just give us a station break with some new poetry. Read us three poems from your new book and we'll be the first people on earth to have heard them. It's coming out from Wesleyan.
Look at you.
Well, you know, your last program went to the moon. You knew that, didn't you?
I did not know that, but I appreciate
you. Well, I'll tell you it. I'll tell more about it. I mean, I've sent you to the moon. The rest is up to you, Ramika.
Right. I mean, really.
I did all I could.
Poets and poems. The poet and the poems on the moon.
We yes, 200 of them, of the modules. The only podcast on the moon, and it's poetry. So let's hear your new poems, Ramika, our favorite.
Okay, so we're going to do three poems in a row?
Let's do it and set them up.
Okay.
My audience can handle three.
Oh, you're right. You know, your audience will come back and tell me, you know, all kinds of things. So I trust them deeply with these poems. So the new book that'll be out in 2024 is called Room Swept Home. And it is a deep labor of love that I've been working on for more than a decade. Two of my grandmothers, one great-great-great-grandmother, and then my maternal grandmother, crossed paths in Petersburg, Virginia in 1941 in a very strange set of circumstances. They, of course, did not know each other. They certainly didn't know that they would be part of the stretched strain of folks who would usher in me. But historically, it was so interesting and significant. One of them, Minnie Folks, my paternal grandmother, was interviewed for the WPA Slave Narratives around that time. And so much of the book is written in her voice and from her experience. And so this poem is a puzzle. It's called Night Class, Peabody High School. And the same wonderful local teachers, one whose name is Susie R.C. Bird in Petersburg, Virginia, a Black woman, also went and taught many of the elderly how to read after interviewing them for the WPA Slave Narratives. So this is a poem in her voice. 1936, night class, Peabody High School. They've taught me how to put the alphabet to my name. Been counting for years, but never had letters. Most of the class, twice or three times as old as the teachers here. What will they make of crooked teeth and letters? They are good and patient children, cleaning the board filled with our sad chicken scratch. They understand letters that barely touch. They want so much for us in our dwindling years. They hold us dear. We're their unplanned letters. Miss Sue, one teacher, visits the market, buys from my garden, always mine, says, "You got some stories, Miss Minnie," tracing freehand letters. Sometimes we sing, sometimes we sorrow. These brick walls hold secrets most won't write down. I read headstones now, their stone-clad letters. They won't take money, in exchange for teaching, say, "You're owed this and more." We thank them by returning, opening our doors. They help address our letters.
Sometimes we sing, sometimes we sorrow.
Yes, indeed.
More, so, please.
You know, part of my bent with this new book is trying to make sure I illuminate some of the ordinary folks who had extraordinary lives. Right? And so my maternal grandmother, who is the one who intersects with many, was sent to the Central Lunatic Asylum for the Colored Insane in 1941 in Petersburg, Virginia, after birthing her first child. It was postpartum. We didn't know much about it then. And so she was sent there after an incident that I'll read about. This poem is June 18th, 1941. The clothes are on fire. In her mind, the clothes are covered in blood. The spot of lard or flour from cooking spreads until her clothes are tar and feather. The clothes are another body, a scaly skin, an animal covering a fresh kill. The clothes are a burlap sack filled with wet cotton, a factory of tobacco, a winding sheet. Years later, the clothes will be the evidence neighbors use, the talk they'll whisper that children overhear and sing as taunts. That's why your mama's crazy, running through the streets naked, and you just like her. Children will say to her daughters, and the fabric will unravel again and again, like the long night, the lost year, the still burning mind.
What would happen if you did not write these stories?
You know, they'd be lost to us forever.
We wouldn't know.
They'd be lost to us forever. And these
keep going.
Brilliant women who, you know, made a way for all of us. I think it's important for us to illuminate them. And so the book kind of ends with me being born and kind of where these women and the history of the country sits kind of in that moment. And many of these poems are written for women, some of whom are in my family, but some of whom I don't know. This poem is written for Beulah Mae Donald, whose son Michael Donald was killed, and you'll hear about that in the poem. But she went on to do something miraculous that I'll talk about in the poem too, so I wanted to illuminate her. This is 25 days after I am born. A man was killed in Mobile, Alabama. It is 1981. Nearest what some will call the last lynching in America. The business of our nation goes forward, Reagan says. A star leads and hostages are freed while Michael Donald walks from the corner store. He is 19, the youngest of six, a college boy. He will miss class the next morning and Sunday dinner. He will not bring the cigarettes to his sister. Those weeks after spiriting me into the world, my mother watches the news, looks over at my father too frequently, calls his name each time he heads to another room, delirious in her exhaustion and fear. Where was he? Would he disappear? And the little girl, what world was this for her to enter? Crosses burning on the county courthouse lawn, then other sons with ropes and guns, looking for anyone, find Michael Donald walking. Ask him for directions, a sign for Old Hinks. They show him the rifle, and what can he do but be forced into the car, driven past this life into the next? Years later, in an unimaginable victory, his mother will bankrupt the KKK, demanding they pay for her loss and others, while my mother, like so many, carries me daily to school around the corner, insists on watching until I am beyond the large blue doors. Mothers are God again,
and they will not go quietly. They know everything born will need to be fed, even children hung from low branches in their jean jackets and muddy tennis shoes, carried out of the wood into the light of everyone's suffering.
That's Rameka. That's Rameka Bingham Mercer. She says, he will miss class the next morning. Yeah. He will miss Sunday dinner.
Yeah.
Driven from this life into the next. Simple yeah. words. Mm-hmm. Those words are not ornate. Those yeah. words are not Latinate. Yeah. They're simple words we say to each other every day.
Yeah.
Sunday dinner, class. Mm. And this is what a poet is.
Mm.
I think that this is a premiere that we're really lucky to have. And the title of that next book is what?
Room Swept Home.
Room swept home. Yeah, I was trying to write already. These
poems for my grandmother. So I'm so glad that you pick up on the simplicity in the language. I wanted to make sure they understood every word that I put down about them.
Well, what we get, even in your grandmother learning the alphabet, is gratitude.
Yeah.
Gratitude is what we get in this book and in mm-hmm. your book. And that's what that is the wind under the sails of this book. It yeah. is the gratitude I get. Yeah. But back into Soul Culture, yeah. beautiful, beautiful cover. I do want to know if you think you've said everything, or if it excited you into wanting to say more things, or if you wish you had added some more people. I bet it was hard. So what are your feelings? Do you feel complete about the book?
I will say, you know, I'm a writer, so I never feel like I've said everything, right? But I really and truly, you know, this is a book beyond my dreams, because I never dreamed that something like this would be a possibility. It wasn't anything that I thought about. And I tell people, Beacon was so wonderful. You know, there are beautiful portraits in the book. You know, I've printed emails from old friends and love notes that people wrote me, and conversations with my husband, and songs I play with my children. It is a hybrid text in as many ways as possible. And I imagined, if I never got to write another book of prose, what is everything that I would want to see there? And everything that I would want to see there is there.
And I love the photos.
Yeah.
And I love some of my best people, Honoree Jeffers,
yeah.
how it really immortalizes them, although they're already immortal.
Yeah.
But yeah. We do want another reading from the book.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mentioned my friend Romaine, so I'm just going to read a little bit from the chapter that stems from an essay with Patricia Smith, but also talks about my friend Romaine. The essay is called Standing in the Shadows of Love. I hope you know that old Four Tops song. When Romaine dies, no matter what book I bring to bed or which tracks blare through my headphones, I am restless and afraid. I am so new to being a mother, so new to living with the double fear that Black men carry as a weight balanced atop my own young Black woman's already triple fear. Not to mention having to balance this with hope and a brave face for my small son's sake, who is still, as Patricia Smith puts it, sweet in that space between knowing and not knowing. One poem in my last book of poems, Starlight and Error, Benediction, bears the line, "Bless the boys who loved us before they were forced to be men." Mm. It is a prayer, a pleading, a wish for some grace in the face of childhood. In other words, I am asking the world to give Black boys time to be silly and abundant, to grow into men, not to be pushed into adulthood. It's a petition for the sanctity of youth, as if that will solve anything. How strange it is to realize in the days after Romaine's death that once and for always, we are no longer children. Sometimes I forget how many seasons have passed between experience and memory. We met when we were just teenagers in middle school. Amidst my grief, I write about losing time. In the poem Solstice, I am a still point, and my children, like me, have lost their trust in anything, anyone. Here's a bit of that poem. When you discover you are old enough that nothing has novelty, you live with teenagers who've learned little more than to abhor everything. I hate daylight savings time. I hate Virginia. I hate being here. If we can steal their light and time without warning, what joy is there to be had? What can they love without fear?
Ramika Bingham Risher, you know, I was glad you read that because I have always looked at you with wonder about how you entered a family with two children already and what you call yourself beyond other things as a stepmother. And in this book, you weave your family into your professional life. You weave your family into how you approached the children to give them what they needed to see from their point of view, like your daughter, Beyonce. Lemonade became a very important piece of music for you too.
Yeah.
So in this book of high thinking and quick learning, there is always the domesticity. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about how you felt that was part of the whole?
Sure. I mean, when I got married, it was Adwater Instant Family, and there was actually three kids. My brother-in-law, Jonathan, who was 16, came to be with us. My daughter, who was 12, Santa Ray, and my son, Michael, who was 4 at the time. My son is 17 now, so that gives you an idea about how much time has passed since all of this. But, you know, when they came to me, I was already firmly in the middle of the writing life, so they haven't known anything different. They've only known me as a writer in the house. So it was not strange for them to see me hold up with a book. I always have a book, if not multiple books in hand, open somewhere, you know, saving pages. And so they knew that. They also knew right away I started kind of crafting poems, and I would let them see the poems that I was writing about them. And if they had any qualms, those poems wouldn't see the world. They're pretty good. They don't censor me much. So it was useful. But for them to understand, oh, this is what Ramika does. She is a writer. And also now she's helping to take care of us. Mm. Right. So there was never any separation of those things. There was just me finding more ways to make time to ensure that I got to do all the things that I love, taking care of them and still writing these books. Mm. So that was kind of the way that I maneuvered around, you know, new family life. But now, you know, they know my grandbaby is 4 now. My daughter is 24 and has a grandbaby. And he told me last night as we were playing his favorite game, I spy a blue book. That's what he said. And he said, and it's your book and I'm your biggest fan.
My baby. And in all this, she's also the director of Quality Enhancement Plan Initiatives at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. On top of all this, let us have a final reading from the book.
Sure. Thank you so much for this, Grace. I'm going to read from one of the final essays, Revision as Labyrinth, about my dad, as I said, and also about Tim Siebels, who's a wonderful teacher of mine. The essay, set it up a little bit for you, really talks about how revision has become the life's work of myself as a poet, and how I learned that it's okay to change and do things differently. And I learned that from my father. My father and I lost some years, but from another angle, we've gained so many. Our lives are more than the things we lose. You are surely more than the slivers you'll come back to or free or discard over time. Revision, then, must ultimately be about care. How do we frame ourselves in the past, in the future, in the current moment where we have hindsight and the power to mold how we've emerged in our hands? How can we peer into another reality or scrutinize it through new eyes? Often, art is the only way. Revision can be inventing our existence, where we stand. I'm a girl who maybe should be broken, who should find it difficult to weather false starts, but my father has saved me from this paralysis. He has started life after life, and for that matter, so has my mother, forced as she was to learn to care for all she loved in the thick of the ever-changing moment. Now that we've seen the bottom, we are not entirely afraid to straddle the edges of the barrel. We slide down past the rim and inch our way up again. This is how the writing comes, just like the living, in fits and starts and possibility.
Ramika Bingham Risher. She starts the book by saying she's looking for a home, and I think she's found it. I think she's found it with her readers. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. This series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.